We now are embarking on what I think of as the real heart of the course, American society, how it really works, as we will explore a variety of themes around the problem of inequality, equality, and particularly this elusive notion of fairness or justice, which is the value that's in play primarily in this part of the course. This is also, just so you know, the part of the course where my own research bears most directly. You know, faculty who lecture to you in various courses also do research. And for at least half of my career, the central focus of my research has been on the problem of social class and its consequences, its forms of variation, and various problems connected to class. So this is where some of my own work will come to bear most systematically on the themes we'll be exploring. Inequality has become a topic of some political salience. Last year during the Occupy movement, which I'm sure all of you were at least somewhat aware of, the big slogan was, "We are the 99%. That was invoking an image of American society, 99% versus 1%. It was a way of talking, in of course a rhetorically sharp way, a way of talking about the character of inequality. So you can imagine a society in which, of course, there would be inequalities, but no one would want to characterize the inequality as 99 at the bottom versus 1% at the top. Some systems of inequality, the main thing one would want to talk about are the deprivations at the very bottom compared to everybody else. That would be a different kind of imagery of inequality. It would be the 90% at the top versus the 10% at the bottom, so to speak. That wasn't the way the Occupy movement decided to, the people who were participating, felt the nature of inequality that mattered most in the present era. They characterized it as a tiny elite at the top, 1% versus 99%. Well, what we're going to be doing in the next 4 weeks is exploring a whole variety of themes connected to inequality. In this lecture today, I want to focus more on the moral issues involved, on why we should even care about it. Why is inequality something that triggers moral concern? Inequalities enter into discussions of society mainly in two different ways. There's sort of two different settings in which we think about inequality. One are moral concerns. Inequalities are facts about society which are linked to what might be thought of as avoidable human suffering. Inequality is linked to avoidable human suffering. And many people regard that connection, the fact that human suffering is connected to inequality, as a source of moral concern. That when many people live lives that are shaped by the facts of inequality, live lives that involve unnecessary suffering, many people think this is at least undesirable. I think most people think it's undesirable, but also unfair. And that's what triggers this set of moral concerns. The second way that inequality enters the discussions of society is that it figures very centrally in different kinds of explanations. If we want to explain things like crime or government policies or health or various kinds of social conflict, there's all sorts of things we might want to explain in which inequality is an important part of the explanation. In this lecture, we'll mainly focus, as I said, on the moral concerns. In much of the rest of this block of the course, we'll look at the explanatory problems, how inequalities of different sorts figure into our explanations. So let's begin by talking a bit about what it even means to talk about fairness or justice. Fairness and justice are closely kindred concepts. They're sort of kissing cousins. Some people think of these as essentially alternative words for the same thing. Sometimes people make a distinction between what's fair and what's just. Every society contains a broadly shared set of beliefs about what is socially just and unjust, what is fair and unfair. So here's the basic problem. I'll tell you why this is something we think about. We observe some empirical case of an inequality. We see that some people are better off than others. You don't need any fancy theory to observe that simple fact. Some people do well, some people do badly. Some people live fulfilling lives, others unfulfilling lives. Some people are healthier than others. These are all inequalities that you observe. Whenever you can say, in comparing two people, more than and less than, you're observing an inequality. And we ask then, is this inequality justified? Is it just or fair? Does the inequality violate some principle that we feel has moral weight? Now, some inequalities are simply the result of bad luck. So, here's the kind of paradigmatic example. Two people are walking down a road and one gets struck by lightning. Another does not. Now, we have a dramatic inequality in their fates. Certainly, one is better off as a result and one is worse off. And there's a sense in which some people would say, and kids often say this, that's not fair. That person didn't deserve it. Right? That's a common, somebody has some terrible misfortune and they say, and a kind of immediate response may be, it's not fair, they didn't deserve it. Such expressions, I think, reflect a very deep moral intuition. It needs, of course, elaboration, but it's a deep moral intuition that I suspect is pretty universal, not all that culturally specific, which says people should get what they deserve and deserve what they get. It's a simple kind of glib formula. People should get what they deserve and deserve what they get. And when you're struck by lightning out of the blue, of course, lightning doesn't come literally with blue skies, but you get struck by lightning, hit by a truck, that's so unfair, they didn't deserve it. My kids used to say that when they were little, something bad happened, if they got sick and couldn't go to a party, they would protest that it wasn't fair that they were sick. I'm sure you all have recollections of such unfairnesses in life. Now, when we talk about a social injustice, not just an unfairness of bad luck, but an injustice, what we mean is that there's something stronger, I would argue. To say something is unjust is a stronger claim than just that it's unfair. And here's how I would put it. I think an injustice is something which is unfair, which could be remedied. It could be remedied. The unfairness could be reversed if our social institutions were different. Something could be done about it. So when we say that it was a social injustice for African Americans to be denied admission to all white universities before the civil rights era, when we say that was unjust, what we mean by that is not just that it was bad luck, so to speak, to be, quote, born black in the United States in that era, but that this grossly unfair inequality could be remedied by a change in social institutions. Now, this doesn't mean that it was necessarily politically possible to change those institutions. Before the Civil War in the United States, it was not politically possible to change slavery. In 1830, it did not mean that slavery was just, simply because it was impossible politically to change the institution. The test as to whether it was unjust is this an unfair inequality for some people to be slaves of others? My answer would be yes. And could it be otherwise? Would a change in institutions eliminate that unfairness? And again, I think the answer would be yes, even if you couldn't achieve that change because of the historical conditions. So you can see why discussions of political of injustice become really complicated very quickly, because the idea of social injustice really involves the coincidence of two diagnoses. And each of these isn't all that simple. First, you have to decide, is the inequality in question unfair? Is there some sense in which the people at the top and the bottom don't deserve what they get? And secondly, is there something in principle that could be done about it which would eliminate the unfairness? It's not fair that some children are born with physical disabilities. They don't deserve it. A child does not deserve to be born with physical impairments. But in and of itself, being born with a physical disability is not an injustice. What becomes an injustice is if there are things that could be done to compensate for that physical disability, to make their lives go well in spite of the disability, and we fail to do so. A nice example that I like to use is the issue of curb cuts. You know, in the world in which we live today, as a result of legislation, when you go on a sidewalk and you hit the curb, there's a curb cut, so that a wheelchair now, but not when I was growing up, but now, a person in a wheelchair can navigate the streets. They can go from a sidewalk to a street and back to a sidewalk. It also means, of course, that people pushing baby buggies have an easier time getting across streets as well. The lack of curb cuts in a street is an injustice for people with disabilities who have to use a wheelchair. And that injustice was remedied by the Americans with Disability Act, which forced cities, made it a law, that you had to accommodate within certain constraints needs of accessibility. That's why buildings today have ramps and other provisions to make it possible for people in wheelchairs to navigate a world which otherwise would create insurmountable barriers for them. And that's really the way I think we should think about it. Something is unfair and something could in principle be done about it, then the unfairness becomes an injustice. Now, at the bottom of this, of course, we first have to diagnose whether something is unfair. And that turns out, in social contexts, not to be so easy. Now, nobody would say that it's fair that a child is born with cerebral palsy. You know, the unfairness of a physical disability from birth of a child, I think, is transparent to everyone. But lots of inequalities which we observe are matters of contentious debate as to whether or not it is unfair. Let me give you an example of an inequality which very few people would say is unfair, a social inequality. Two neighbors have identical plots of land. Each has the same time and resources available for growing vegetables. They're both under the same constraints. One works hard and the other does not, and at the end of the summer, one has lots of veggies and the other has little. Now, most people would say there's nothing unfair in that inequality. That, in a sense, each of the people in this little story chose the inequality. The inequality was the result of their independent, autonomous choices as to how they wanted to spend their time. To be sure, something could be done about it. You could redistribute the tomatoes. But most people would say that was unfair, right? To redistribute the tomatoes from the hard-working tomato neighbor to the lazy tomato neighbor, to redistribute those tomatoes would be unfair since they each had the same choice to begin with and the same resources and opportunities to begin with. And indeed, if you redistributed the tomatoes, then you'd have the following situation. The lazy neighbor, the grasshopper from the famous Aesop fable, the grasshopper and the ants, would have had both a summer of leisure and a winter of tomatoes, which actually creates an inequality. If you take both neighbors in total, what their lives were like, one worked hard, one worked less, one, and they get the same amount of tomatoes, that's unfair to the hard-working tomato grower. That's the famous Aesop fable of the grasshopper and the ant. And that's a very compelling fable. The fact that that fable is thousands of years old and still has resonance today, it still makes complete and total sense today, corresponds to, I think, most people's intuitions about fairness, reflects the fact that people feel that having control over your own destiny and then choosing to not work hard means that you don't deserve more. So the grasshopper and the ant both get what they deserve and deserve what they get. But that requires a pretty complex kind of reasoning. You have to really look at the details as to how the tomatoes were grown, what the resources were of the two farmers, and in the story insist that they both really faced the same set of choices and just chose differently. There are many other kinds of examples, however, which aren't quite so simple. I'm going to give you four cases. And in these cases, I think almost everyone would consider one of them an example of an injustice, and one of them would be something that almost everybody would say was not an injustice. And two of these examples are cases where the unfairness of the inequality at least would be a source of debate. Okay, so here's the four cases. Case number one, a police chief will only hire personal relatives, sons and daughters and cousins as police officers. This is a public employee, a public police force, not a private security firm. You know, a police chief only hires his relatives. Second case, a small shop owner is only willing to have his son or daughter become the co-owner of the store. No one else will be allowed into that position. The third case, a 30-year-old inherits $10 million from a grandfather. And the fourth case, in one of the richest countries in the world, there are millions of people, children and adults, who live in desperate poverty. These are four cases. Now what I'd like you to do is take 5 minutes, well, let's say 3 to 5 minutes, I'll sort of see what the sound level of your discussion. I want you to discuss these and decide which you think are fair and which are unfair. And if you think one of these is problematic, what about it makes it problematic? Okay, so discuss these. Turn to the people next to you, behind you, form little gaggles of discussion groups. Everybody has to say something. I'm going to look. The TAs are going to look and be sure that everybody is involved in a discussion. All right, it's like our 3-minute meditation, 3-minute discussion. Discuss the issue. What's fair and unfair about each of these cases? I'm watching. I don't see everybody talking. Come on. Okay, I hear the noise level subsiding. I think that's a signal. Okay, so let's go through each of these. Number one, Fair or unfair? Somebody, tell me what you think. Yeah.
Unfair.
And why do you think it's unfair? Okay, so it's the public, yeah.
I think
it's his store and he owns it. No, we're on the first one still.
Oh.
First one, yeah, we'll get to the, you'll get the second one. Yeah, so on the first one, I think the public character of it, and we just have this strong belief that everybody should have an equal opportunity for that job, not just a personal connection, and above all, not just a family connection. It gets a little complicated in practice if you say personal connection, because lots of jobs, people find out about the job because of personal ties. And so personal factors and social networks impinge on all sorts of jobs that officially we want to think of as being open to everybody. But still, I think the first one is a pretty clear case. Second case. Okay, so private property and private ownership seem to, I think, most people, and for good reason, to provide a good grounding for access to at least some jobs in the firm that you own. But what about the owner only hiring whites for the job? It's his private property. Why shouldn't he be allowed to only hire white workers? I'm not talking now about a co-owner, but what if he only wants to hire white workers? Private property, you should be able to decide what you do with it. The government comes and says, no, you cannot discriminate on the basis of race. Well, what do you think? Is it unfair for a private property owner to refuse to hire a black person for a job? I imagine in this day and age, most of you think that that's unfair. And it's an unfairness that something could be done about. We could make it illegal, which is, of course, what happened eventually after a couple of centuries of it being perfectly normal. 100 years ago, even in Wisconsin, if somebody had asked the question, should white business owners be allowed to refuse to hire blacks, most students in this classroom, I think this classroom probably is 100 years old, so you can have this fantasy. You're sitting probably the seats aren't 100 years old, but you're sitting in a classroom where this question could have been asked 100 years ago. I suspect that most undergraduates at the University of Wisconsin 100 years ago would have said, of course, it may be wrong, they shouldn't do that, but it's not unfair. Not unfair, it may be sort of bad taste or bad manners or some violation of what would be ideal, but it's not unfair because private property rights allow you to do what you want. We no longer believe that. And I think that's moral progress. I think it's an advance that we now understand that private property shouldn't give you absolute power to decide what to do with your property, that there should be some constraints on it, and one of the constraints bears on this question of inequality and justice, that it's unfair for this small shop owner to not hire people, but we still, of a particular race, let's say, but we still feel that when it actually comes to having a co-owner, having a partner, well, that's something that the shop owner should have complete discretion over. That's not a simple distinction to make. The distinction between hiring somebody and having somebody being a co-owner. It's not so easy to actually ground that justification. I don't think it's impossible, but you can see why the distance becomes smaller once you admit that there should be restrictions on your use of your private property in hiring. Well, why should there be just restrictions just on hiring rather than on co-owning? Okay, that's just a difficult question. I'm not saying that there aren't justifications. It's just a hard question, and you open the door to that question by admitting that discrimination against employees is unfair and unjust. That's one reason why very strong supporters of private property rights, libertarians, would say, no, it's perfectly fair for a private property owner to refuse to hire blacks. It may be nasty, it may be mean, it may be immoral in the sense of our private views of morality, but it's not unjust because private property gives you absolute rights to decide what to do with your private property. That would be the kind of standard libertarian kind of view on this matter. What about the third case? A 30-year-old inherits $10 million from a grandfather. Is that fair? Unfair? What do you think? Nobody has any opinions on this matter. Yeah.
We want to know how they inherited.
Well, the grandfather died and had in his will. The grandfather was a rich guy, had a lot of good investments, and in his will he says, $10 million to my grandson. Simple, straightforward, you know, garden variety inheritance of the sort we have all the time. Yeah. Other views? Yeah?
I'd say it's unfair because the man doesn't deserve what he got, but it's still just because it's bringing someone up and not bringing someone down. So it's unfair, but it's not unjust.
Well, that's interesting. It's unfair, but not unjust, even though you could do something about it. That is, if it's unfair, we could certainly have rules. We don't, but we could have rules that say you just can't inherit that amount of money. You know, we could put some ceiling on how much you can inherit on the grounds that it's unfair for the child to receive that much money. Yeah?
I think it's fair because the grandfather earned that money within his lifetime, so he chooses how to allocate it after he passes.
Yeah? Yeah, it wouldn't confiscate it. It would just reduce. Yeah, there is an inheritance tax. People who oppose it call it a death tax to make it sound kind of creepy and evil. There is a tax on inheritances, which is broadly in the spirit that at least we should reduce the inheritance because there's something that seems suspect about it. Anybody want to defend the idea that it's basically unfair and should be severely restricted? So that's, you know, this I think in American culture, in our society, with our norms and the rules of the game under which we all live, it seems perfectly normal to have large inheritances. One way of thinking about it, which is a little awkward, I admit, but one way you might think about it is that it's fair for the grandfather to give the money, but it isn't fair for the kid to get the money. It gives the kid all sorts of undeserved advantages. The kid gets advantages, which gives him unequal opportunities in life, which he didn't earn. But it's fair for the grandfather to give it because the grandfather earned the money. So you have this kind of tension. I think this is the tension that was kind of captured in your intuition, right? There's something asymmetrical about this relationship, right? It was kind of fair to give away your money. After all, it's your money. Of course, we might have a diagnosis that's an even sharper one if we don't think it's fair for anybody to have $10 million to give. It's another question. But assuming that we're not indicting the grandfather's acquisition of his wealth, seems fair to let him do what he wants with it. But there is something that I think niggles at least makes one a bit uncomfortable, or I think ought to make people uncomfortable, with the notion that there's something fair in the outcome. Because it certainly creates an inequality between the son, the 30-year-olds who get $10 million inheritances and the 30-year-olds who don't, as they make their way in life and try to accomplish things, one has advantages that the other one doesn't have, not due to their own effort. It's not like the garden example, right? It's not the two farmers who work hard or not. Yeah. It's a very difficult issue. We'll be talking about that. What I think we should do is to really rethink the whole notion of how income is distributed and what the rules of the game are, the basic rules of the game by which people acquire their wealth, and try to approach this in a way which tries to produce, as best as we can, more just outcomes, which does involve thinking about the question of redistribution, which is, of course, something that goes very much against the grain in the United States. Talking about redistribution seems to be talking about taking the tomatoes from the farmer that worked really hard to the lazy farmer. But in fact, I don't think the issue of redistribution is about taking from people who work hard to people who are slackers. It's trying to remedy a situation where some people have a capacity to act in the world with much greater resources than others. It's as if the one farmer gets the good, fertile land and the other gets the crappy land, and they both work equally hard, and one has three times as many tomatoes because they got the good land. That's a different story from the grasshopper and the ant story. If the basic resources that you have at your disposal to make your way in life are different. What about the fourth case? In one of the richest countries in the world, there are millions of people, children and adults, who live in desperate poverty. What do you think about fairness, unfairness in that situation? I mean, I could just randomly call on somebody, but that could be cruel, so, yeah. And why do you, what's unfair? Okay, so we have one person who feels that there's basically something unfair. Now, this doesn't yet say what we should do about it. That's another question. But that there's something unfair, and therefore something should be done if we can. Come on, somebody else has an idea on this. You were all talking about it. I'm sure you were talking about this fourth case. All right, I'll randomly pick somebody, and this could be unfortunate. I'll randomly pick somebody. Okay, how about the guy in the gray shirt, about sixth row down? What do you think? That's you, the guy in the gray shirt with the big grin on his face. Okay, so that's a really interesting and thoughtful response, that it's unfair on the one hand, but on the other hand, you have to have a certain amount of poverty in a society like ours. That's the way it's set up, that's the way it runs, and therefore it's hard to know what to do about it. So that's an issue we will be discussing. Do you need poverty in order to have a well-run society? Is it a necessary ingredient? Now it could be, you know, it could be that you need the fear of deprivation as a way of motivating people to work, for example. And so if you got rid of deprivation, people would just all be slackers. That's one kind of perspective. Yeah. So it's a reality of capitalism that there are winners and losers because of competition, and that'll generate inequality. But that doesn't necessarily mean it has to generate desperate poverty. So capitalist economies will generate inequalities, The question is, are there all things you can add to capitalism, some countermeasures, that retains the competitive character that enables the system to work, but eliminates the sharp deprivations that the system tends to produce? This is an issue which we'll discuss. Now, if you can eliminate it, if it is possible to eliminate the sharp deprivations, especially for children. So in this statement for case four, I put both children and adults. If we restrict it to children, it becomes pretty hard to say that it's fair in a rich country to have millions of children, which is true in the United States, millions of children who live lives of very deep deprivation. It's pretty hard to say that's just fine, that's fair. It could still be the case there's nothing to be done. You know, it could be that all things considered, that's the best we can do. But if it isn't all things considered the best we can do, then it becomes a serious, I think, injustice, not just an unfairness. All right. Why does it matter whether you think an inequality is unjust? These are all cases of inequalities. Why does it matter? I think it matters because when people feel something is unjust, they're more likely to support efforts to change the practice, the institution, than when they think it's fair. Injustice provides motivations for people to act against their interests. That's a really important thing to think about. Moral concerns, of which injustice is an important category of moral concern, provides motivations for people to act against their interests. So think of it this way. In politics, people support a given set of policies, whether it be tax rates or education support for different kinds of people or income support, whatever. You know, people support different kinds of policies for two different sorts of reasons. First, it's in their personal interests to do so. So if I, as a well-paid professor at the University of Wisconsin, acted politically just on the basis of my personal interests, I would be a strong Republican because I earn enough money that the tax policies of Republicans are pretty good for me. Although I might have some concern about whether their policies will wreck the whole economy, that's another question, but just in terms of tax policies, broadly speaking, people in my income range should be super conservative. But that's not the only reason why people support policies. They also support policies because they think some policies are the right thing to do. They satisfy moral concerns, not just personal interests. There are many rich people that support tax cuts for the rich because this is in their personal interest. But there are other people, Warren Buffett, for example, who argues that the rich in the United States are grossly undertaxed and advocates for a sharp increases of taxes on wealthy people. There's an organization in the United States called Millionaires for Tax Increases. That may not be the exact name, but it's essentially an organization of very wealthy people dedicated to raising their own taxes because they think that's the moral thing to do. It's just, it's right, it's the way that the society as a whole will benefit. So people are willing to do things against their personal interests when they think it's necessary for justice. And that's why I think arguments about the fairness or unfairness of inequality matter. Because they provide a grounding, not just for the poor to want programs that help the poor, but for the middle class and the wealthy to support programs that help the poor. So now let's look at the nature of the arguments for around justice and injustice. How should we approach, in a more systematic way, evaluating whether particular inequalities are or are not just? One way of capturing a contrast is to think about two different ways, or to frame it as two different ways that people think about fairness. One is with the expression fair play, and the other is the expression fair shares. Fair play says everyone should be equally free to pursue their interests, equal opportunity for the pursuit of happiness. And fairness means there's no discrimination, no disadvantages, an equal playing field. You know, that sports metaphor is used. The result is high levels of inequality, of outcomes are fair, so long as the outcomes were obtained through equal opportunity. The little tomato story at the beginning, my parable, and the grasshopper and the ants parable, that's a fair play parable. That says if you have equal starting conditions and there's no foul play, there's no unfair rules of the game, then whatever inequality comes out at the end is fine. There's nothing unfair about it, nothing suspect about it. That's the fair play framework. Fair share says everyone is entitled to a share of society's resources sufficient to live a dignified, flourishing life. Fair share means everybody deserves a share sufficient to live a dignified life. Sufficient means enough to be able to participate fully in the exercise of rights and liberties, to be able to exercise freedom, to live decently, to develop one's talents. Everyone in this perspective, in a fair share perspective, says everyone has a human right to good health care, to decent housing, to decent nutrition. This should not be contingent upon how successful they are in competition. Even if they're unsuccessful in competition, they shouldn't live below some level that would count in the culture as a dignified level of life. The focus in fair share, therefore, is on outcomes. And this is the usual way that fair play and fair share are distinguished. The usual way it's distinguished is to say, in fair share's perspectives on fairness, you're concerned with the outcomes. Does everybody have enough to live decently? Whereas fair play is only concerned with procedure. Is the process by which people acquire their income, let's say, is the process fair? If it's fair play, then the outcomes are irrelevant. Fair play is, I would argue, the dominant view in American life. Fair play is the dominant way people think about fairness. That's why the notions of equal opportunity figure so strongly. Equal opportunity is a fair play expression, right? You can see how that captures the fair play idea. And why the sports metaphor, Americans really like sports metaphors. The equal playing field is a constant sort of sports metaphor used to discuss fairness. Most people say that as long as everyone has equal opportunity, then inequalities in what people earn doesn't matter. Aaron Rodgers and Bill Gates deserve their high income because they're so great. They didn't cheat. They played fair. They worked hard. They certainly worked hard. So they deserve it. They get what they deserve, and they deserve what they get. And I do think that is the dominant view. I don't think, however, that it's actually the only view that most people hold. I think people simultaneously hold both of these views in some unclear amalgam. There's some very interesting data where people were asked to think to indicate what distribution of wealth they think actually exists in the United States and what distribution of wealth they think would be the ideal for the United States. So I could ask you all, you know, to take a pie chart and divide it up into five pieces. And what percent of the total pie do you think the top 20% should own? And what percent of the total pie do you think the bottom 20% should own? And a study was done that asked a random sample of Americans what they think the ideal is and what they think the United States is really like. And here's what the results look. They think for the United States itself, how Americans think it is spread, they think that the bottom 20% gets a bit, if you can see the, so here's the top, this is how Americans think it's spread, that the top 20% they think gets about 55%. They think the fourth, the second 20% gets just about 20%, and so on. This is how they think it's, this is how they think it should be. They think the bottom, the top 20% should get about 30% of all wealth. And they think that the bottom 20% should get about 10%. So the average American thinks that the worst off people should get about half their proportionate share. The bottom 20% should get about 10% of the wealth. This is what the distribution actually looks like in the United States. All right, so the, first of all, the things to note are the actual distribution, the top 20% have about 85% of all wealth. That's way higher than most Americans think is the case. But look how different it is from what they think is the ideal. This looks much more like a fair shares perspective. This kind of looks, I mean, that's not that far off from equal. And a really interesting thing is, if we look around the world at countries and see what countries actually look like, what Americans think would be the ideal, this is Sweden. This is what Sweden is actually like. This is the actual distribution of wealth in Sweden. This is the distribution of wealth that would be completely equal, 20% everywhere. This is the distribution of wealth in the United States. This looks very close to what Americans think would be the ideal. Now, that's a bizarre result. I mean, when you think about it, you know, Sweden is the most redistributive European economy. They redistribute. That's why it's that equal. And that's what Americans, when they're asked the question, what would be the ideal, this looks a lot like Sweden. So, my point is that I think these moral ideas about fair play and fair shares, I don't think it's the case that Americans, in their deeper intuitions, so to speak, in their moral heart, are committed to fair play and don't care at all about the outcomes. I think the average person sees both of these as relevant concerns. They want fair play, but they don't want people to suffer desperately. They want both things. They care about outcomes and they care about process. And therefore, in evaluating our institutions with respect to these values, I think both values are relevant, not just the fair play perspective. Where are we? Okay, I think we're okay. All right. Here's the fundamental problem with fair play as a doctrine. That is, if you just take fair play alone and forget completely about fair shares, here's the basic, I think, the most fundamental problem is the fate of children. You know, if so to speak, if we lived in a world where there were no children, then fair play might be tolerable. In a world with children, fair play is hard to imagine it satisfies our moral concerns. So long as children are raised by parents, so long as that's the way that children are raised, and there are very good reasons to think that that's the best way to raise children, is to have them raised in families with loving parents, then massive inequality of the life circumstances of parents undermines fair play for children. And that's the reason why the fair play doctrine just doesn't work in a world with children. You can't have fair play alone without worrying about fair shares. So long as children are raised in families and living in a family which is deeply deprived undermines the fair opportunities for children. you can see if you really take the idea of equal opportunity seriously, so if you really do believe in equal opportunity, then the distance between fair shares and fair play is reduced. Because if you want to have children with remotely equal opportunities in life, if you believe that fair play means fair play for children, not just fair play for the tomato farmers in my story, but fair play for the children born into this world, then we cannot allow any children to grow up in conditions of dire poverty. Growing up in conditions of dire poverty is a profound violation of fair play. But growing up in conditions of dire poverty is what happens if you don't worry about fair shares. This means that if you're serious about fair play and the idea of equal opportunity, then you have to worry about the distribution of outcomes. You have to achieve, in order to achieve even a very rough notion of equal opportunity, you have to take care of the problem of the fair shares that adults live under. And that makes for a much more complicated moral universe. It's abdicating moral responsibility to say we don't have to worry about the level of inequality under which parents live, because to abdicate that responsibility really means you're not taking seriously fair play for the children. Children, therefore, I think is the most salient aspect, not the only one, but the most salient aspect of having to worry about the injustices of inequality. Now, there are complications. And the complications provide a grounding for a defense of unjust inequality. Now, that sounds a little weird. How do you defend an injustice? Well, there are defenses of injustice. The first is that there are conflicting values. Justice is not our only value. We have other values. Some other value may be more important than justice. For example, private property rights or parental rights. So one way of handling the grandfather case is to simply say, yes, it's unjust, but there's another value that's more important than justice, and that's private property. So you've got two values, they're in conflict, and one trumps the other. Or another kind of case, wealthy parents can provide for expensive, high-quality schooling for their children. And there's no way, I think, that one can with a straight face say that that doesn't violate equal opportunity for children. I mean, after all, the very reason why these rich parents are providing expensive private schools for their kids is precisely because they feel it gives them an advantage. So either the parents are wasting their money, they're just stupid, because it doesn't provide an advantage, or it does provide an advantage, and if it provides an advantage, it violates the principles of fair play. Right? So we have a conflict. It's unjust to have an educational system in a world where education really matters. Education doesn't matter just because you'll enjoy opera more. It matters because it gets you a good job. So in a competitive world with competitive labor markets, education matters terrifically, and yet we allow parents to buy very high-quality education for their children. You can't say with a straight face that that isn't unjust. Now, you can say there are other values besides justice which are more important. Parental care of their children and doing everything they can to make the lives of their children go well is something that I think everybody deeply values. I certainly deeply value. And because I value that, I see there being a deep and serious tension between the value of equal opportunity, which I also care about on grounds of justice, and the value of parental rights to take care of their children as best they can. These conflict with each other. And when there's a conflict of values, it's often very hard to know where to come down on. And the usual way that in a political context, in a healthy political environment, you come down on it is you try to balance the two. You don't let one completely trump the other. You try to balance the two values rather than have one always triumph over the other. So that's one reason why that's one way of defending an unjust inequality. It's not that you couldn't do anything about it, but doing something about it would violate some other value you care about. There are also, however, what can be called pragmatic arguments for inequality. This was raised in the answer to the question about, you know, my fourth case, when the idea that maybe you need poverty. So saying you need poverty for the economy to work well, that's a pragmatic argument. It's not saying poverty is good. It's saying it's necessary. But not good. It's not that it's morally desirable, but that it, for practical reasons, it's necessary. The pragmatic argument for inequality looks like this. So this is a kind of schematic way of representing it. So here's, it's basically three theses put together. First thesis, inequality creates incentives. If you have inequality, then people are going to work harder because they want to do better. If you have zero inequality, working harder doesn't enable you to do better, right? So inequality produces incentives. Incentives mean people work harder than they would without the incentives. And people working harder generates prosperity. And prosperity ultimately benefits the poor. So this is the argument that the rising tide lifts all boats. You've heard that expression. The idea is you do tax cuts for the rich, you create more inequality, that creates incentives, people work harder, you get more prosperity, and even the poor will do better. The second thesis says, if the first thesis is true that inequality creates incentives, then it seems natural to say greater inequality produces greater incentives. You know, some inequality produces incentives, more inequality produces more incentives. This is called a linear argument. Linear argument. It means not just that there's an association between two variables, inequality and incentives, but the more of one, the more of the other. Greater inequality produces greater incentives. This will produce even greater prosperity, and this will even greater benefits for the poor. Now that's a pretty wild idea. That says that the poor are better off the more inequality you have. So it's not just that a certain amount of inequality is good for the poor because it provides incentives, which they benefit from through trickle down, but the more inequality you have, the better it is for the poor. And the final thesis is that if you reduce inequality, you reduce incentives, and this ultimately harms the people at the bottom. Now, if you believe all of these are all just, these are pragmatic arguments because each of these is simply a statement about the consequences in the world of different states of these variables. It's just a practical statement of this is empirically how the world works. If you believe all of these, the practical policy implication is tax cuts for the very rich and trickle down for the rest of the society. Well, needless to say, I'm sure you can predict, I'm not a big fan of this pragmatic argument. I believe it's filled with holes. Let me just briefly say what I think is wrong about them. First, there's a problem. Now, here's another technical term. There's a problem of what can be called endogenous preferences. That's a nice bit of jargon for you to write down. Endogenous means something that is generated inside of a system, and preferences are what your preferences are. So here's the basic idea. How much incentive you need to work hard depends upon the level of inequality that's seen as normal. The bigger the inequality, the more incentive you need. So it's not that the bigger inequalities generate bigger incentives. It's that if you live in a world with big inequalities, then you need a big reward in order to feel any incentive. In the United States, in the 1950s, the level of inequality between managers and workers in most American firms was about 25 or 30 to 1 between top managers, the heads of firms and the corporations and the workers. Now it's about 400 to 1. It's not the case that executives work harder today than they did in the period of rapid growth of the 1950s and 60s. It's just that as inequality increases, the expectations as to how much reward you need in order to feel satisfied goes up. Japanese managers have way lower inequalities with workers than American managers, and yet Japanese corporations are efficient and innovative and highly competitive. Same for German corporations. It's simply not the case that greater inequality produces greater incentives. Rather, the very preferences people have is shaped by the environment of inequality in which we lived. If we lived in a world of much more muted inequalities, then people would care a lot more about small differences rather than big differences. Second point, the role of power in generating inequality. And this has to do with a distinction which I don't think is very subtle, but it's not immediately obvious. It's the distinction between an incentive and extortion. If I hold a gun to your head and say your money or your life, and you give me your money, would you describe that as an incentive for me not to shoot you? No, you'd say I've extorted your wallet from you. I have robbed you of it through the use of force. It's an exercise of power on my part, not an incentive. And that, I think, is bound up with this question of inequality and incentives. People will call the high earnings they receive incentives, but incentives can simply be an ideological mask for maintaining advantages. Privileged elites always say they need more to be motivated to work and to produce. They always say that. I mean, there are exceptions. Warren Buffett says, no, this is ridiculous. We don't need more. But generally, wealthy people say they need everything they've got and more. But this is often just a bluff. Think of this as a game in which there are threats and bluffs backed by power. And the outcome, the level of inequality that a society tolerates, is the result of politics, political battles with winners and losers, not just incentives. And finally, there's the problem of excess inequality, having more inequality than is needed for incentives. You do need some inequality for incentives, but how much? The second thesis is simply false. The first thesis is correct. You need some inequality for incentives in many contexts, but it's false that the more inequality, the more incentives. And then the question is how much inequality is optimal, rather than should we tolerate whatever inequality is generated. That's the criticisms of the pragmatic argument for inequality. Now let me give you a pragmatic argument against high inequality. So this is on practical grounds why high inequality is bad, why it creates undesirable outcomes. First, high inequality undermines a sense of community, which can generate resentment, conflict, the erosion of the sense of mutual obligations, and this in turn can fuel all sorts of disruptive social pathologies, crime, social conflict, and others. All of these have the effect of lowering productivity. Conflict is costly. So if high inequality leads to resentment and conflict and social disruption is costly to the economy, to the society, because of the costs of social control, then high inequality is going to reduce productivity. So it's not just that it doesn't generate necessary incentives, it imposes costs on the society. As we'll see when we discuss the consequences of poverty in the United States, the levels of imprisonment of the United States in the United States are the highest in the world, and this is incredibly costly. California spends more money on prisons than it does on higher education. That's hardly a recipe for a highly productive society. Secondly, high inequality leads to concentrations of wealth, which support concentrations of power, and this undermines democracy. This is a theme we'll discuss in the last part of the course. And finally, and this may be less obvious, I think, to most people, but it's important and interesting, high inequality actually harms most people, not just people at the very bottom. The problem of inequality in the United States is not just that it creates desperate poverty at the bottom. High inequality in the United States affects most people in the United States in an adverse way. Let me just present some data to show you this. I'm going to go fairly quickly through a series of slides. These will be on the website. These are not in the book. These will be on the website. So this is an index of health and social problems. It combines all of these facts into a single number, into an index. It's not important to know how they combine the measures of all these, but it goes from a society that is better on these, so that in terms of these social problems, they score better to worse. And here are measures of inequality, of income inequality in the societies. And these are rich countries. So we're only looking at rich countries here. You can see the United States. It has the highest levels of inequality and the worst scores on these, on this combined index of social problems of health and social conditions. And you can see that the other rich countries fall remarkably close to a linear relationship. What this indicates is that inequality itself, not merely poverty, but inequality, how unequal is the society, generates problems. If you simply look at the relationship between how rich the society is and that same index, you see there's no particular relationship. So it's not that high inequality produces these problems, but the wealth that goes along with that high inequality might neutralize it. There's no association between per capita income and that relationship. If you look at states in the United States, you get the same relationship. Here's Wisconsin. We're pretty good on the American spectrum. We're at the low inequality end of the spectrum among states. There are almost no states that have less inequality than Wisconsin. And we're also better on this scale of social problems compared to most of the rest of the country. It's quite remarkable that the same relationship that holds for countries also holds for states within the United States. That's, in kind of social science terms, that's really a fantastic result that the same phenomenon occurs. This is the UNICEF measure, that's a United Nations organization, measure of the index of child well-being, going from better to worse. And once again, the United States is not the worst country for child well-being, but we're at the low end, and there is this inverse relationship between child well-being and income inequality. Child well-being and average income among rich countries is not related. So the wealth of a country doesn't determine the well-being of children. The inequality in the country does, among rich countries. So we're not talking about all countries in the world. We're talking about the rich countries in the world. Levels of trust are higher in more equal countries. That's part of this idea that inequality erodes a sense of community and reciprocity. And that's also true in the United States. And once again, Wisconsin, let's hear it for Wisconsin. Wisconsin's pretty good. It has lower inequality and relatively high on the trust scale. Mental illness, the same story. The higher the inequality, the higher the prevalence of mental illness in the society. Inequality generates stress in people's lives. life expectancy. The higher the inequality, the lower the average life expectancy. Infant mortality, same story. The higher the inequality, the higher the infant mortality rates. Teenage birth rates. For teenage birth rates, the United States is way off the linear relationship. We are an outlier, but in the same direction. This is by states. Teen pregnancy rates are a function of inequality. And finally, and here I'll end with this. This is a measure of social mobility, which is essentially how closely associated are the income of adult children with the income of their parents when their parents were at about their same age. So the closer the association of your income with your parents' income, the lower the mobility, right? Your parents determine your fate. The United States has the lowest levels of social mobility of any of these countries, along with the high levels of inequality. Inequality does not promote mobility. Okay, that's it for today. Next time we'll talk about social class.